democracynow.org. Our guest has been Keyser Khan. His new memoir is just out. It's called An American Family, a memoir of hope and sacrifice. And he has a young people's book. This is Our Constitution, Discover America with a Gold Star Father. We'll post part two at democracynow.org. Thank you.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland.
At KBOO, we think that all communities deserve to be fully informed on the policies and decisions that will impact their lives, and we need your help to make that happen. We're looking for citizen journalists to help collect, report, and broadcast the news. Do you think that there are groups that are underrepresented or marginalized by the mainstream media? Are you aware of social, political, or environmental activities that don't have adequate visibility? Are there important issues in your town or region that aren't getting coverage? This is your chance to give a voice to the voiceless. You don't have to have experience, and you don't have to come into KBOO's Portland studio. You can contribute from wherever you live. If you have some basic writing skills and a desire to get the word out, we want you. Just send an email with your idea and contact information to newsdirector, that's all one word, newsdirector@kboo.fm, and include the words citizen journalist in the subject line, and the news team will contact you. Once again, send that email to newsdirector@kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of KBOO at the Clinton screening of Romeo is Bleeding on Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Romeo is Bleeding is a documentary that follows Dante Clark, a young poet transcending the violence in his hometown of Richmond, California, by writing about his experiences. Dante and the like-minded youth of the city mount an urban adaptation of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet with the hope of starting a dialogue about violence in the city. PDX Poetic Justice's John Slaughter and his group of poets will be reading some of their works before the screening. Again, that's KBOO at the Clinton screening of Romeo is Bleeding on Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
It is 5:01, and KBOO Evening News is coming up next. This program has been made possible by KBOO members and support from Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Androids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Vice President Pence broke a tie to end a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau ruling that allowed customers to sue their banks and credit card companies.
President Trump signed an executive order ending his temporary ban on all refugee admissions to the U.S. while calling for a 90-day review of the program for 11 high-risk countries.
And President Trump also signed a directive today to increase the number and complexity of drone flights here in the U.S.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, October 25th, 2017. I'm Aaron J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael has found a diversity that the powerful approve of.
While the media is shocked and outraged that men in power use that power to abuse women, and Trump continues to disrespect and attack women, veterans, people of color, anyone, even Republicans who disagree with him, the Senate makes big cuts in Medicare and Medicaid to give tax breaks to the rich and corporate while increasing the deficit, which will mean more cuts to programs for the neediest and basic infrastructure. The needy least are in a tizzy to decide where to buy a house to replace their soon-flowing other beach property, and which congressman will yield the best return on investment as the Defense Department scrambles to find countries we don't have soldiers in yet and other new ways to spend increasing funds. A savings account would give me 0.1% interest, but my credit card charges me 18. No need to donate blood when we're being drained by vampire capitalism and the new shackles of American slavery are minimum wage and overcrowded classrooms, no longer limiting that inhumane tyranny to one race or the newly arrived. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
Are you a Portlander?
Talk about
for...
what...
Sorry about that. Are you a Portlander looking for somewhere else to move for a better career or business opportunities? Forbes magazine says stay put. They put Portland on the top of their list of the best places for business and careers 2017. Forbes writes, the influx of educated young adults has been a boon to the $157 billion economy, with household incomes up to 4% annually rising since 2011 and unemployment falling below 4% from a peak of 11.3% in 2009. Apparently, housing prices, racial diversity, and traffic jams did not enter into their equations. Seattle came in third, just after Raleigh, North Carolina, and ahead of Denver and Des Moines.
Nicole Bowles is a member of the Preserve Coalition, an organization that promotes physical and brain health for African Americans over 55. She'll be speaking at the Talk and Taste Lecture Series at the June Key Delta Center tomorrow from 1 to 3 p.m. Kyle Qureshi spoke with her earlier today.
Talk about what Preserve Coalition does specifically.
So Preserve Coalition is a group of individuals from nonprofits, health institutions, and the African American community here in Portland, which the goal is to serve African-Americans who are over 55, and we work with them through a various series, including the Talk and Taste series, which will occur tomorrow between 1 and 3 p.m. And the overall goal is to minimize disparities that lead to high blood pressure, diabetes, and other conditions that impact brain health.
And what specific expertise does the members of the coalition have?
Themselves come from a large background. We have former real estate developers, as well as individuals who focus on mindfulness research. I come from a sleep and biological rhythms background at OHSU, where I'm a postdoc in the Institute of Occupational Health.
Okay. And tell me more about the Talk and Taste series. And there's an installment of it tomorrow?
Correct. So, yeah. So tomorrow from 1 to 3 at the June Key Delta Center. That's partly because the Deltas are co-sponsoring the event. And this year we're only having one event, but usually it's a series of talks. This year it's going to focus on the impact of sleep and, again, on the older African-American community and the importance of keeping a good sleep, healthy routine, as well as the impacts of on your health when you don't do so.
And why is there a specific focus on people older than 55? It seems like a lot of the ailments that you provide treatment for would be people found in people older than people who are 55.
I think in part because their overall interest is on brain health, and so obviously that's going to impact an older population.
Right.
And then because of health disparities, they're more likely to be impacted by various health ailments.
Okay. This is random curiosity, really, but does the coalition do anything to treat sickle cell anemia?
No. So, because our focus, again, is a lot on brain health. So, mm-hmm. And then things, you know, the brain isn't completely separated from the rest of the body. So we do also have interest in hypertension and overall heart health, as well as diabetes, because those things are also known to impact how your brain functions, whether that's, you know, memory, mm-hmm. Ability to sleep as well.
And what is SHARP?
So SHARP is one of the programs that Preserve, I guess they're so they serve as the oversight, I believe that's the correct term, the oversight committee for the SHARP program. This is a program that's led by Dr. Raina Croft in the neurology department, I believe it is, at mm-hmm. OHSU. And I think she's been going for a little bit over a year. She's actually looking for two individual males who are retired to participate. But basically, it's a walking program in Portland where individuals go through neighborhoods they used to live in, and it helps to jog, or they talk about memories from when they were younger.
Okay.
And the goal of it is to, again, help with memory and recall.
Mm-hmm. And how can people gear up for the lecture tomorrow?
By coming out, honestly. There's nothing to do. There will be food available as part of the Talk and Taste name, hence the taste part. We'll have treats available, healthy treats, with the goal of boosting one's brain potential. And just come up with an open mind, willing to ask questions. Myself, I'll be speaking, as well as Andre Pruitt, who will be talking about the importance of getting the African-American community engaged in research.
Mm-hmm. And what sort of research are you going to present at the event tomorrow?
So overall, I'll be begin discussing the importance of keeping a nice sleep routine, as well as the impacts, particularly on cognition and heart health, if you do have poor sleep. And then I'll get into a little bit of details about some of the studies that we do in my current lab, again, with the among a larger group in the Institute of Occupational Health.
Where and when is the event tomorrow?
The event tomorrow is at the June Key Delta Center, and it's from 1 to 3 p.m.
Okay. And is there anything you want to add, anything you want to tell the audience?
So just to give a little more detail about the kind of research that we do, I won't, because I'll be briefly discussing it tomorrow, but we're interested in the behaviors that, and how they, your behaviors, such as the time you go to sleep, eating, smoking cannabis, and how that impacts heart health. So we do that in a few different ways. One is a survey. We have the survey is particularly interested in cannabis use and how that impacts sleep. And then we also have another ongoing study that's a five-day in-lab study. It pays well, $1,800 per participant. When you come to the lab, we alter your sleep-wake cycles in order to see how sleep interacts with your own biological rhythms. And if you're interested in those studies, you can email us at circadian@ohsu.edu. That's CIRDIAN@ohsu.edu.
All right. Well, that's all I have. So, Nicole, thank you for stopping by.
Thank you so much for having me. This is great.
That was Kyle Qureshi speaking with Nicole Bowles, a Preserve Coalition member.
Last week, the Iditarod Trail Committee announced that four dogs from a single team tested positive for the opioid tramadol, and while they initially declined to name the competitor, pressure from other teams forced them to release the name of the accused musher. Dallas Seavey, who is a four-time winner of the race and placed second this year, was named as the offending racer. Seavey has denied giving any drugs to his dog, saying that maybe someone tampered with the dog's food. Since it cannot be proven that Seavey acted intentionally, he will keep his title and $59,000 in winnings from this year's race. The committee has announced a change in the rules beginning with next year's race that the competitors will be held accountable in the future for positive drug testing unless they can prove the drugs were given outside their control. In a video posted on his Facebook page, he stated that he would not be thrown under the bus by the Iditarod Committee and has withdrawn from the 2018 race. All dogs are subject to random testing before and during the race, and it is mandatory for the first 20 teams who finish. This year, five dogs connected to the race died, bringing the total to 150 in the 44 years of the race's history. This has brought pressure from animal rights activists who have attacked the race for the death of the dogs and severe infections and bloody paws. The race also lost a major sponsor this year when Wells Fargo decided to quit backing the race. Iditarod officials say this was due to pressure from PETA and other animal rights groups.
Vice President Pence broke a 50-50 tie in the Senate today to end a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau ruling that allows customers to sue their banks and credit card companies. This puts customers back into forced arbitration with those companies, one of the many things hidden in the fine print we all must sign to get bank cards and checking accounts. Two Republican senators, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina and John Kennedy of Louisiana, sided with Democrats in opposition to the resolution. The resolution has been approved by the House, so it only needs President Trump's expected signature to go into effect. Speaking last night in the Senate, Elizabeth Warren said, "This bill is a giant wet kiss to Wall Street."
A severe thunderstorm with intense winds and heavy rainfall struck Hawaii early Tuesday morning from a storm system that had formed north of the islands. The Maui Police Department issued a release by tweet that said there was an island-wide power outage from the storms, putting 150,000 people in the dark, and that Maui Electric was working to restore power. A teenage girl suffering a leg injury when a tree fell on a bus stop on Ala Moana Boulevard late Wednesday night has so far been the only one hurt in the storm. Flash flooding has also occurred from the heavy downpours closing a part of the Haleakala Highway. More wet weather activity is expected, with the Kona low being attributed to the storms. A Kona low is the northwestern area of low pressure in the Hawaiian Islands in the cool half of the year between December and March. The weaker surface low pressure usually causes winds to shift from the windward direction to the southwest or leeward Kona direction. Most customers on the island had their power up and running by 6:30 a.m. this morning, with 600 customers maintaining power by generators. The power outage also caused a sewage spill in the Wailuku pump station off Kalui Beach Road in Wailuku. 40,000 gallons of wastewater flowed over a dirt access road into the ocean. The site has been cleaned and disinfected with bacteriological tests conducted and warning signs posted.
If you see something in the sky and you wonder if it's a bird or a plane, you can be sure it's not Superman, so it's probably a drone. President Trump signed a directive today to increase the number and complexity of drone flights in the U.S. At least five communities will be selected to create their own trial programs with the help of government and industrial drone users, which the Federal Aviation Administration will review. The FAA would grant waivers, if needed, to current rules and prohibitions, including those on flights over people and nighttime flights. The trial programs could test things like package deliveries, the security of data links between pilots and drones, and technology to prevent collisions between drones and other aircraft. In the past 2 years, the FAA has registered over 1 million drones, the majority of which belong to individuals. There are now more drones registered in the U.S. than manned aircraft.
With Halloween approaching, Trump is offering refugees more tricks and no treats. The president signed an executive order ending his temporary ban on all refugee admissions to the U.S. while calling for a 90-day review of the program for 11 high-risk countries. The vetting process for all refugees, which already takes years for most, will be lengthened, but the administration has not yet given details. Nor have they named the 11 countries that would be subject to the new review, saying only that applicants from those countries would be considered on a case-by-case basis. The new executive order also puts on hold a program that allows for family reunification for some refugees resettled in the U.S. Earlier this month, Trump set a limit of 45,000 refugees a year, down from the 110,000 a year limit put in by President Obama last year. In June, Department of Homeland Security statistics showed that the number of refugees admitted to the U.S. had fallen by nearly half under Trump when compared to the final months of Barack Obama's presidency.
And now it's time for today's report from National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Native American news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Today, we begin a series, State of Change, looking at efforts to build economic resiliency on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota. The Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation was founded in 2007 to build the power of the local community by creating lasting systemic change. In this first report, Jim Kent visits Thunder Valley's offices to uncover what sparked the grassroots effort and what's kept the nonprofit alive.
Thunder Valley Community Development Corporation is located near Sharp's Corner, the last stop for gas, food, and essentials as you approach the heart of the Pine Ridge Reservation. And it makes sense that a group founded through a spiritual gathering should have its home near a tribal nation's heart. Thunder Valley spokesman Andrew Ironshell explains that it all began with venting about the various needs of the Lakota people.
And then that spiritual process became a call to action. So really pointing the fingers back at ourselves and asking ourselves as community people, as citizens of this tribal community, what's our role and what's our responsibility?
These conversations, explains Ironshell, led those in attendance to realize that they could have an impact on their people.
So from those thoughts started this conversation about, well, we do have the capacity to create some change among this small circle that's doing this complaining. And so when we looked around and acknowledged each other's talents and virtues and things like that, well, let's do something together. And so what we have today is kind of a cause and effect of some of those conversations.
Ironshell adds that key to Thunder Valley's development was realizing from the start that there would be challenges with personalities, politics, and available resources. Supporting each other helped in that process, recalls Ironshell, but understanding that change would take time and having the patience to accept that
has been equally important in Thunder Valley's success. For National Native News, I'm Jim Kent.
Next week's State of Change story will look at a language immersion program. State of Change is a project in collaboration with High Country News and the Solutions Journalism Network. Canada's Indigenous leaders have joined the chorus of Canadians mourning the death of the frontman for the band The Tragically Hip. Gord Downie died last week at the age of 53. Dan Karpinchuk has more.
Downie was honored with an eagle feather nearly a year ago during an emotional special chief ceremony in Quebec, where he was named the man who walks among the stars. By that time, Downie had told the world that he was suffering from an aggressive and terminal form of brain cancer. In his final months, he devoted much of his time advocating on Native issues. And part of that was a project called Secret Path, which told the story of Chaney Wenjack, who died running away from a residential school in 1966. All proceeds from the album and the graphic novel are being donated to the National Center for Truth and Reconciliation. Perry Bellegarde is the National Chief of the Assembly of First Nations.
I think it was just his personality, his character. He could walk into a room and everybody would bond. He made everybody feel important. And that was just his gift. And so when I say he made my job easier, he really did. Because he reached and touched people about First Nations issues and reconciliation and social justice. Reached a lot of people that I couldn't as National Chief. So we lift him up in high regard.
The Minister of Indigenous Affairs said Downie's death is an incredible loss. She said he set an example for all Canadians, and she said he will still be a guide during the reconciliation process.
That was Dan Karpinchuk reporting, and I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for News from the Boo. At 6, it's The Underground, followed at 7 by Combined Culture Radio. Tonight's weather is a 20% chance of showers, followed by fog with a low of 48. Today in history, in 1881, Pablo Picasso was born. Before he died at the age of 93, he produced over 50,000 works of art. The quote of the day is from Fats Domino, who died today at the age of 89. Well, I wouldn't want to say that I started rock and roll, but I don't remember anyone else before me playing that kind of stuff.
And now we hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a Diversified Media Enterprises production. I'm Doug Cunningham. Call it Labor's Spirit of St. Louis. The solidarity of the AFL-CIO labor delegates gathered for their convention in St. Louis is up against one of the most challenging times in the history of the labor movement. And for Dan Duncan, Executive Secretary Treasurer of the AFL-CIO's Maritime Trades Department, the location couldn't be more appropriate for a movement trying to uplift workers, their wages, and their power. Because Missouri working families are using a voter referendum to roll back an anti-union law passed by Republicans in the state legislature.
Here we are in Missouri, the epicenter of all the fights right now for the right to work for less crowd. They're trying to roll back cities who increase minimum wage. Here in St. Louis, the minimum wage is supposed to go up to $10.10 an hour, and the legislature and the governor said, no, you can't do that without us. You got to go back to the $7.25. So here's people who had a pay raise for 6 months and lost it.
Duncan says even in the teeth of vicious, well-funded and coordinated attacks on worker rights, workers still have a spirit of resistance and a determination to struggle to regain those rights and improve the living standards of working families. He says these right-to-work laws are designed to destroy the financial ability of labor unions to counteract corporate attacks on working people and our unions.
There's been a lot of solidarity. We all know what it means. I come from Virginia. We've dealt with right-to-work for decades in that state, and now they're trying to do, under Janus, right-to-work for the public sector. We know there's a fight. But there's a heck of a fighting spirit on the convention floor, and people are saying, okay, if we're going to fight, let's fight. Let's give it everything we've got.
American Federation of Government Employees President David Cox says a fighting solidarity spirit is alive and growing in his union as his members engage in a variety of issues vital to them, including protecting the VA from privatization
health care, pensions, and blocking budget cuts to Medicare and Medicaid.
Veterans health care, raising the minimum wage, raising wages, period, taking care of people, affordable health care for all. I personally support Medicare for all in this country. The budget that this Congress is preparing to adopt also has cuts to Medicare and to Medicaid, so all Americans need to be very, very concerned with what we are facing.
Cox says his union is growing and its members are getting more engaged and active on the issues confronting working people.
AFGE is a fighting union. Our members are fighters. We are seeing our membership continuously grow. We're 100% open shops, but our membership continues to go up. We're seeing the activism of our members get more concerned, more focused. People are joining our nationwide teletown halls. People are engaging like they have never engaged before.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit workersindependentnews.com.
And now for a daily newscast compiled by Public News Service.
Welcome to the Public News Service daily newscast for Wednesday, October the 25th, 2017. I'm Mike Clifford. In focus on our nationwide rundown, Arizona progressives see an opening with the surprise retirement announcement by Senator Jeff Flake. Ohio Trump voters among supporters of the 40 MPG standards. And don't look now, but they're installing a new earthquake monitoring system in the Lone Star State. Now our top story, Senator Jeff Flake, the junior Republican senator from Arizona, announced from the floor of the U.S. Senate Tuesday that he will not seek re-election in 2018. The New York Times quotes Flake as saying he will no longer be complicit or silent in the face of President Trump's reckless, outrageous, and undignified behavior. Meantime, Suzanne Potter reports that progressive groups in Arizona say they sense an opportunity now that Flake has decided to retire at the end of his term.
Flake has been a vocal critic of President Donald Trump's political style, and on Tuesday he blasted the new way of doing business in Washington as, quote, not normal. Jocelyn Berry, co-director of Progress Now Arizona, says the president has pushed his party so far to the right that it creates an opening for Democrats in a state where Trump won by only 3.6% of the vote.
What it is it's a sign of how radical and misguided the Republican Party has become. They've let themselves be hijacked by the extremists in their party to the point that they've pushed out someone as principled and reasonable as Senator Jeff Flake. And I think what it really shows is that the Republican Party is really out of touch with the values of Arizona people.
Democrats oppose Flake because he supported repealing the Affordable Care Act, but many say they also admire his support of comprehensive immigration reform. His departure leaves the Republican primary wide open in 2018. The current leading contender is State Senator Kelly Ward, a strong Trump supporter who is backed by Republican strategist Steve Bannon. Kristen Sinema, a congresswoman from Tucson, is the leading candidate on the Democratic side.
Several other Republicans are rumored to be considering a run, including State Treasurer Jeff DeWitt and Robert Graham, former chairman of the State Republican Party. A Hillary Clinton campaign and the Democratic National Committee helped fund research that resulted in the Steele dossier containing allegations about President Trump's connections to Russia, that according to the Washington Post. They report that Mark Elias, a lawyer representing the Clinton campaign and the DNC, retained the company Fusion GPS to conduct the research. Federal lawmakers considering putting the brakes on fuel efficiency standards for cars. Mary Sherman tells us that's a move that might be out of sync with the views of Ohio voters.
A new poll finds voters in five key swing states, including Ohio, support Obama-era regulations that require cars to average 40 miles per gallon by 2025. Voters from all demographics and political leanings agreed. Pollster Elizabeth Senna says what's especially notable is nearly half of Trump supporters across the five states also are in favor.
The president that they voted for, who is attacking these standards, it's his voters that actually support increasing fuel efficiency standards, even if it means their new vehicle could cost a little more.
Knowing that the requirements could add about $3,800 to a new car sticker price, 62% of Ohioans polled said they still support higher fuel efficiency standards. In every state polled, fewer than 3 in 10 people said they oppose the standards.
Automakers who initially supported the standards asked Trump for a review, claiming they're too costly and could result in job loss. This week, we're reporting on the 2017 Race for Results report from the Annie E. Casey Foundation. Today, we take a look at New Jersey. According to Elena Vega with Advocates for Children of New Jersey, it's an index of educational, health, and economic indicators that puts the state near the top of the list.
Asian and Pacific Islander children and also white children in New Jersey actually are number one in comparison to other states. But there is a huge disparity between those two groups and Latino and African American children.
While white children were at 842 on the 1,000-point index, Asian and Pacific Islander children were at 918. The rankings for African American and Latino children in New Jersey were closer to 500. And finally, Mark Richardson reports many Texans think earthquakes are something they worry about out in California, but Texas officials have just installed a seismic monitoring network to study the frequency and intensity of earthquake activity across the state.
The Texas Bureau of Economic Geology's TexNet project will pinpoint and analyze the number of tremors, which many believe are caused by oil and gas activity. Texas State Geologist Scott Tinker, director of the Bureau, says the need for a statewide network has grown rapidly in the past decade.
When earthquakes started happening in places where they hadn't happened before, legislature and industry and regulators and academics said, hey, it'd be nice to get out in front of these potentially and get a network in place and get some baselines set and study them.
The system has 22 permanent stations and 40 mobile monitors, which can be positioned in areas of high activity. When an earthquake occurs in Texas, TexNet will report its strength and location, along with other information. Tinker says Texas quakes, once rare, have increased from about one a year to more than 40 since 2010. Scott Anderson with the Environmental Defense Fund says many geologists suspect waste oil injection and fracking at petroleum rigs are the reason for higher numbers of Texas quakes.
This is also driven indirectly by the experience in Oklahoma, which has had a truly massive increase in earthquakes in the last few years, most of which are believed to be induced by oil and gas activity.
The public can access seismic data from the TexNet website. I'm Mike Clifford for Public News Service, member and listener supported, and online at publicnewsservice.org.
And now for a report by H2O Radio, it's This Week in Water.
We're all exposed and we're all at risk. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
Air, water, and soil pollution are killing more people in the world each year than all wars and violence. A new study published in The Lancet, a British medical journal, shows that about 9 million people died prematurely from exposure to toxic chemicals in 2015.
The study is the first effort ever to determine the number of deaths from all forms of pollution. The morbidity rate may be even higher because some places on Earth are not monitoring pollution and some potential toxins are being ignored.
The report notes that of the 5,000 new chemicals that have been dispersed over the planet since 1950, less than half have been tested for toxicity. In other words, there may be deaths caused by pollutants that we do not yet know about.
While all people are exposed, the authors note that the effects of pollutants are seen most in the young and the poor.
Some startling statistics? The number of people killed by pollution each year is 1.5 times greater than those killed by smoking, 3 times the number of those killed by tuberculosis, AIDS, and malaria combined, and 15 times more than the number of humans killed by wars and violence.
The largest category of deadly pollutants is air contamination from factories and vehicles, but hazards are also found in water supplies that lead to infectious diseases.
The report, which took 2 years and involved more than 40 international researchers, concludes that much of the world's pollution can be controlled and related diseases prevented, but it will take leadership, resources, and clear strategies.
So it's timely that in December, the UN Environment Assembly will take place in Kenya, and its title this year, Towards a Pollution-Free Planet. Participants will, among other things, outline realistic steps to address pollution to protect human health.
If you like to eat nutritious fruits and vegetables, you should thank an insect. And if you like to eat fish, like salmon, you should thank a fly. Those were the sentiments expressed by Scott Black, executive director of an environmental group known as the Xerces Society, in the wake of a study showing a massive decrease in flying insects in nature reserves in western Germany.
Researchers who've been collecting the critters for 27 years have shown a remarkable decline of nearly 80%. They measure the overall weight of the bugs and not the number or diversity of different species.
The results of the study were published last week in the journal PLOS One, but they have not yet determined what caused the decline. The researchers found no evidence that it was caused by climate change, habitat loss, pesticides, or pollutants.
And so far, puzzled researchers haven't found a corresponding decline in insect-eating birds or plants that depend on the bugs for pollination. More research will be needed, but one scientist noted that, unfortunately, there are no studies showing that insects are doing well.
It may be the pipeline project you've never heard of, but for residents of Virginia and North Carolina, the Atlantic Coast Pipeline represents either an environmental catastrophe or a major economic opportunity.
On Friday the 13th, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission approved a permit for the 600-mile pipeline that could cost $5 billion. It's slated to deliver natural gas by running from West Virginia through Virginia and into eastern North Carolina.
In Virginia, the pipeline will cross about 700 rivers and streams, and in North Carolina, about 320 waterways. A spokesperson for the Sierra Club told the North Carolina Independent Weekly that the pipe will release methane every step of the way.
In addition, Hope Taylor, executive director of Clean Water for North Carolina, told the Staunton News Leader that the pipeline would go through communities that are 60% African American and 95% Native American.
The pipeline still must be approved by state environmental agencies.
They're calling it a super typhoon, or the equivalent of a Category 4 to 5 hurricane, and it's predicted to hit Tokyo, Japan on Monday morning, October 23rd.
Recently, Typhoon Lan, as it's called, had sustained winds of up to 150 miles per hour and gusts near 180, and at one point its eye was 50 miles in diameter.
As it passes the greater Tokyo area with its nearly 38 million inhabitants, Lan is expected to weaken, but still be very destructive.
For those in the U.S., Typhoon Lan could affect the jet stream, and as Mashable reports, after a strong typhoon moves into the northern Pacific, weather systems over North America tend to become more amplified, spawning storms and outbreaks of cold air.
With that, finally this week, NOAA's Climate Prediction Center is out with its 2017-2018 winter forecast for temperature, precipitation, and drought. And for the second year in a row, La Niña is poised to be a major factor.
First, temperature. They're forecasting above-average temps for the southern two-thirds of the continental U.S. and the East Coast, as well as Hawaii and western Alaska. It could be chillier in Washington state and along the Canadian border.
And for precipitation, drier conditions are very likely along the entire southern U.S., and the odds are that the northern states like Montana and the Dakotas will be wetter than average. Although that sounds like good news for the northern plains, which have been in exceptional drought, forecasters say it won't offer much relief because the ground in winter is often frozen.
As for California, the huge snowfall last year might be a distant memory because models indicate it will be less wet and a bit warmer.
That said, while NOAA makes long-term predictions about temperature and precipitation, it doesn't make any claims about the frequency or severity of actual storms.
In a press release, they explain that even though the last two winters had above-average temperatures, many parts of the country saw significant snowstorms. It's difficult to predict snow events more than a week in advance because they depend upon the strength and track of winter storms.
The Climate Prediction Center will update its forecast in mid-November with news about La Niña and other weather-making patterns. This Week in Water is supported by the American Water Works Association. Water quality experts will present the latest science and research in the field at WQTC in Portland, November 12th through 16th. Learn more at awwa.org/WQTC.
4 Special Forces troops died in Niger last week, and at this point it is still unclear why they were there to begin with and why they were not better equipped. Marine General Joseph Dunford told reporters Monday that the soldiers were sent on a reconnaissance mission and intelligence suggested there was a low risk of enemy contact. But they were sent with no air support and were only given support by the French, who were under orders not to intervene or return fire. In a mission such as this, standard procedure is to travel in armored vehicles. However, they were in standard pickup trucks. And so far, no explanation has been given as to the rescue helicopters were from private contractors instead of Marine personnel, who left Sergeant LaDavid Johnson behind and took 48 hours to track his locator beacon before recovering his body.
A video calling for an Islamic State battle in the Democratic Republic of Congo appeared online and in news reports this week, even though that country is overwhelmingly Christian. Since 2014, the battle against this little-known Islamic militia has been used as a cover for the illegal resource trafficking mafia and violence against the people of the Beni in northeastern Congo. Ann Garrison from KPFA has more.
A video calling for an Islamic State battle in the Democratic Republic of the Congo appeared online and in news reports this week. KPFA's Ann Garrison has the story.
According to the U.S. State Department, the 79 million people of the Democratic Republic of the Congo are 50% Roman Catholic, 20% Protestant, 10% Congolese Christian Kimbanguist, 10% other Christians and Jews, and only 10% Muslim. Other sources estimate that the Christian population is as high as 95%, while the Pew Forum, the Encyclopedia Britannica, and other sources report that the Muslim population is no greater than 2%. In any case, the Democratic Republic of the Congo is such an overwhelmingly Christian country that it's preposterous to propose that it become a new Islamic State battleground. The Roman Catholic Church is the country's most influential non-governmental institution, with schools that educate the majority of primary school students and hospitals, clinics, and businesses, including farms, ranches, and stores throughout the country. The jihadi video was purportedly made in Beni territory within Congo's North Kivu province, where a phantom so-called Islamist militia, the Allied Defense Forces, has been blamed for massacres of the indigenous population that began in October 2014. It features a bearded, camo-clad North African or Middle Eastern man draped in ammunition belts and holding a Kalashnikov rifle while speaking Arabic to call on Islamic State jihadists to come to Congo. Black African militiamen stand behind him. Boniface Musavili, a native of Beni and author of the book Congolese Genocide, From Leopold II to Paul Kagame, said that this imagery is meant to further convince Westerners that Islamic jihadists are responsible for the Beni massacres. He also said that Congolese President Joseph Kabila, who is clinging to power despite the expiration of his last constitutional term in office, seeks to benefit from escalating violence, instability, and security crisis throughout the country, which makes holding an election difficult. Western perception of a jihadist threat in Congo also distracts from the country's internal crisis and provides cover for illegal resource trafficking in minerals, ivory, and timber in Beni.
This is both to create a cover for the trafficking of wealth of the Congo and attract the sympathy of Western countries on a so-called Islamist peril in Beni in Congo.
Musavili added that Muslims are no more than 2% of the population in Congo and in Beni, and that they have never waged a political struggle or a violent demonstration against the government as Muslims.
As you know, the Congo does not have a sociological basis large enough to host a jihadist movement. Muslims in Beni and in Congo are only 2% of the population, and they have never waged a political struggle, nor even organized a violent demonstration against the government.
The Congo Research Group at New York University has produced a new report on the militias responsible for mass killing and illegal resource trafficking in North Kivu's Beni territory. They said that these militias, quote, all use the identity of the so-called Islamist Allied Defense Forces as a cover for their activities when it's politically expedient. In Berkeley for Pacifica, KPFA and Afrobeat Radio, I'm Ann Garrison.
We'll be right back.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Sam Bowman and Dan Raphael. The producer is Kyle Carezzi. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Zelos Marchand. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Erin J. Bernard.
And I'm Brian Pritchett. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7 o'clock, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Voices from the Edge with guest host Lisa Loving. At 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch. Teresa Mitchell will bring you the news you are not supposed to know. At 10 o'clock, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. And at 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11 o'clock, on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with Eileen Miles about her new book, Afterglow, a dog memoir. Ghostwritten in part by Pitbull Rosie, it explores geometry, gender, morality, evil, aging, and plaids. And at 11:30, on The Film Show, filmmakers and organizers from the 44th Northwest Filmmakers Festival join us in the KBOO studio. KBOO keeps you informed, and you can get involved. Go to kboo.fm and click on Donate to become a member.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
Hello and welcome to News from the Boo. This is your weekly update about what's going on in and around KBOO. I'm your host this evening, Delphine Crescenzo, and I'm joined by Jenka Soderberg, KBOO's web and social media coordinator. Welcome, Jenka.
Thanks, Del. It's good to be here this evening.
And today we are talking to you all folks because we have a request for proposal for folks to actually submit, and we are looking for an on-site IT contractor. And so Jenka is here to help us understand who we are looking for and what the duties would be for this person. So first, Jenka, I would love if you could help all of our listeners understand a little bit of how things function at KBOO. And so you're part of the tech team. Could you share a little bit about who is part of the tech team? Because